In the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer. Amen. Amen. Another great reading, another wonderful gospel, another point of thought and contemplation coming to us at just about the right time in our national life, because 2 weeks from Tuesday is the election, and we'll be electing many leaders, in addition to the president, many, many leaders. Doesn't God sometimes either has a sense of humor or irony? I don't know exactly which it is, but nonetheless, this is here this morning, and perfect it is. There's an expression, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And at least I think that the tough make sure in one way or the other that hopefully they'll be on the other side of whatever the calamity is that they're in the midst of. John and James surface in our gospel this morning, the sons of Zebedee, which means thunder, by the way. So that was their family name, but they were also nicknamed Thunder Wagner days by Jesus. The only two actually that Jesus had nicknames for that we recognize, James and John. Men of action. They formed kind of an inner circle with Peter. That triumvirate, Peter, James, and John, appears very often. These are the two we're talking about, along with Peter. Peter went off in a very different kind of direction in terms of managing his leadership skills. But James and John seem to have had some special aptitude for this. But nonetheless, the trio, are there at critical moments in Jesus' ministry. They are present at the Transfiguration. You might recall Peter, James, and John. He takes them up under the high mountain, and they witness him being transfigured. And they're with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And when Jesus is having those agonizing moments, it is Peter, James, and John who are with him. And we know that they're kind of take charge people, because in Luke there is a kind of a stray reference, which we don't hear too often. Jesus is just really getting into trouble, and his detractors are around him, and things are not going well. And so James and John propose quite rightly, in essence, Jesus, you have the power. Why don't you call down fire from heaven and incinerate them all? Tempting. Tempting. No surprise, they speak up because they feel threatened, and so does Jesus. And Jesus, of course, says, absolutely not. That is not mine to do. It is certainly not mine to call on God. At this point in Mark's gospel, Jesus has just predicted for the third time that he will suffer, die, and rise on the third day. And it isn't getting any easier the number of times they hear this. But this is the third time, and now they're thinking there must be something to this because they keep bringing it up. And an unease and uncertainty over them all. And that's the context for James and John thinking, well, somebody's going to have to be in charge when he's gone, and it better be us. So that's the lead-in. We want you to grant the one thing we're going to ask you. Just kind of be a little obsequious about that. They're basically saying, the ship is sinking, and when the lifeboats are being loaded, we'd like to be in them ahead of everybody else. Secure the seats. And what Jesus tells them is really what he's telling all of us as well. Yes, they're called to watch with him and to share in his ministry. They're also going to be called to live and one day die for him. But to attain power and glory is not Jesus's to give. I mean, do we ever think of Jesus as having limitations? And this was a big limitation. He could not usurp the power of God, burned through very long and hard discipleship. It is alone God's will to bestow. bestow that. God's reward, God's prerogative for those who truly serve God. And then he reminds them in very, very familiar words about servants and slavehood. But again, we lose it because we don't have the Greek. First, he says, you must be a diakonos, a servant. Diakonos, which survives in the modern word for deacon, the diaconate. That's part of our three orders of ministry. But the original Greek means one who waits on tables. One who waits on tables. So if you want to be followers of me, you have to be someone who's willing to do the dishes and clean the kitchen and pick out spittles and get down on your hands and knees. You have to be one who wants to do that. And then a second D word comes in, and therefore you also must be a doulos, D-O-U-L-O-S, which is Greek for a male slave. You must be a doulos, a dedicated person. Slaves in antiquity generally had lifelong relationships with their owners. In many cases, they were treated very well. In many cases, they were liberated upon the owner's death, which was the only way the relationship ended. I am not endorsing slavery by a long shot, but that word meant something different to Jesus' hearers. And that survives today in the modern word doula. If you're a woman assisting another pregnant woman in childbirth, you are willing to be with that person to the end, to what will hopefully be a happy and wonderful birth. You are a doula. You are a slave to that one. Jesus speaks of true leadership that embraces this aspect of both diakonos and doulos, service and humility. Not the false, obsequious kind of humility that James and John kind of present at the beginning. You know, we just want to ask you one thing. It's not too big, but we're just going to ask it anyway. That's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is not talking about false humility or uncritical confidence. Jesus is talking about the kind of leadership that emerges by being humble and being a servant. He sets them up for the big question. But the humility that tempers the appeal of power, that humility is the one that deals also and reveals human frailty. Or to put it differently, he tells them what the cost of true leadership incurs. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Shakespeare, Henry IV. Or, in management terms, it's lonely at the top. James and John want to understand really, I think they really do, what Jesus is trying to tell them. And they don't ever find out until they are alone with him in the Garden of Gethsemane, because Mark has a dual play on this image of cup. They've just had the Last Supper when Jesus offers them the cup of salvation. Now he brings them apart in his agony, in his prayer, in his realization that he will now pay that price for the kind of servant leadership he has proposed and led. And apart from others, they hear him pray, "Father, if this cup might be taken from me, please do that. If this cup of destiny can pass, let that happen. But nevertheless, your will be done." And I think that's the time they really understand what Jesus means. The cup, the symbol of the Last Supper that Jesus has shared with them, now becomes the cup that only he can drink. I've had, you know, different days of my life and things I've, you know, been too tired. Had some downtime. I think we all do. We all have had that. But I remember in particular the one night of my life that I really was thinking about what was going to happen the next day, and that was the night before my ordination to the diaconate. And it was not because I wanted this. I felt called to it. I had doubts, but I felt that God was just the will of God for my life.
demonstrate a certain amount of humility, but you might want to talk to my wife to get the true reading of that. Still, the sense that I was going to be in some ways changed by this, and part of the church, and part of Jesus' ministry, and I was leaving behind something, my lay status, just my birth, in a way, as that person to become this other kind of person, another order of ministry. And I remember that very clearly, that last night before ordination. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote a lot about James and John in one of his books, and he had this to say, ironically, about 2 months before he was assassinated. And he had read another book by J. Wallace Hamilton, a Methodist minister, who brought up this concept of the desire to be a drum major, the drum major instinct. And Martin Luther King said this, "You know, at some level we all want to be important, to surpass the others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade of human existence." Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contended that this is the dominant impulse of our lives, the quest for recognition, for attention, the desire of distinction, of achievement, that is a basic impulse, a drive of human life. As you know, King went on to write, we often begin our early lives with this first cry. Even as a baby, we cry for attention. And then all through childhood, that drum major instinct is there beating away in our ears. It can become a major obsession. Maybe in a way James and John heard the drum major beating away in their ears. And so I can understand and I can forgive them. We want our leaders to be strong and confident. We want them to have answers and solutions. We want them to be right. And yet, at some level, we want them to be human, caring, willing to admit error or doubt. We want them to lead us from in front as a drum major. We want them also to walk with us as human beings. We want them to know something of the frailty of life. We want them also to know something of the great gifts that life can bring us. We want them to realize the cost that true leadership is. James and John were great with the first part of the equation. They got that right. Drum majors galore they were. It was the second requirement that eluded them until that night when they saw Jesus ready to lay down his life for all those he loved. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be a diakonos and a doulos.